Well, are you on the shadow? I said, you compare me to one of the best players in the world. What shadow? I score 30, 20, 25 goals in the National Hockey League. I'm a pretty decent player. So, but you compare me to a guy that scores 60. I said, okay, I'm okay with this comparison. You're not comparing me to the guy that is playing in the minors or, somewhere in Europe. So I said, I'm in a pretty good shape.
That was Valeri Burre, and you are listening to the Up My Hockey Podcast with Jason Podolan. Just watch me now. Welcome to Up My Hockey with Jason Podolan, where we deconstruct the NHL journey, discuss what it takes to make it, and have a few laughs along the way. I'm your host, Jason Podolan, a 31st overall draft pick who played 41 NHL games, but thought he was destined for 1,000. Learn from my story and those of my guests. This is a hockey podcast about reaching your potential. Hey there, welcome to or welcome back to the Up My Hockey Podcast with Jason Podolan. I am your host, Jason Podolan, and today we are going back down memory lane for me as I'm bringing on an old Spokane Chief teammate of mine in Valeri Burre. Valeri Burre, as well, many of you, if you are NHL fans, should remember Valeri Burre, but if you're an NHL fan at all, you will remember Pavel Burre, Valeri's older brother. So they both came over from Moscow the same year, which we cover in this episode. And Valeri ended up with us in Spokane, while Pavel ended up in Vancouver with the Canucks. And they both had prestigious NHL careers. Pavel had like a Hall of Fame caliber career, scoring 60 goals and was the most lethal goal scorers of his generation. And Valeri had an amazing NHL career as well. And we cover that in the interview, just about, you know, what it was like to be Pavel's, you know, little brother and how that was for him as far as, you know, being compared to Pavel and, you know, being from the same family and what it would be like to live in his shadow. So this episode definitely is not about Pavel. It's about Valeri. And I just want to make that clear because Valeri was a heck of a hockey player. And I mean, heck of a hockey player to the tune of 68 goals in 66 games in the WHL. He led the world junior team for Russia in scoring. And, you know, he was a prolific goal scorer himself. And there was a lot of things that that I took away from my time with Valeri and things that I would use kind of the rest of my career, whether it was how he curved his stick and the time he spent in the stick room and how he would shave the toe of his stick and the curve of it was something that I was always drawn to. He had one of the best releases that I'd ever seen at that time. And really still to this day, it a quick release of a shot that fooled goalies all the time. He was super agile. He was a guy that took his training very seriously, even in season in Spokane, that he was doing stuff that nobody else was doing as far as plyometrics and attention to workouts. Like I said, that other guys just weren't doing at the time. And he was kind of a professional when we were all juniors, in my mind, would be the way that I would put it. And whether that was from his father, and we talked about his father lots during this interview and the impact that he had in his career, or whether that was, you know, from having a superstar older brother that was 3 years older than him and watching the way he trained. But there's definitely a piece of Valeri that was professional and that was business. And he had the mentality required during a very, very, very tough time in the WHL, like annals, you know, as far as like the toughness of the hockey. And Valeri was not a big guy. He was 165 pounds in the WHL and 5'11", 5'10". And for him to not only survive, but to thrive in that environment, especially coming over from Russia and not knowing the language and, not being able to share in the jokes in the locker room, like what he was able to accomplish there in the WHL is a testament to his mindset, to his mental makeup, because there was nothing easy about playing hockey in the WHL at that time. So, yeah, we get into a lot of it here. Which I really love. It was great to catch up with him. I mean, I haven't geez, I don't know. I mean, maybe seen him at some point after Spokane, but, you know, 93, 94 was the last season he had in Spokane, and I don't remember too many opportunities to speak with him since. So it's been a long time. So any Spokane Chief listeners out there, this will be a great interview for you, and also a great interview for just hockey people in general. He has a lot of great things to say here, and over the next hour and 15 minutes, I'm sure you will appreciate the stories and the insight that he offers. So without further ado, let's bring you my conversation with Valeri Burre. All right. Well, welcome to the podcast, my old teammate from Spokane, Valeri Burre. Welcome, boss.
Well, good to see you. I like how you introduced me from Spokane. I'm not from Spokane. We met in Spokane.
No, you're definitely not from Spokane.
But I'm actually from Moscow, Russia.
Yeah, that's right. From Moscow, Russia, where we met was in Spokane in 1992. Yes. And that's where our paths crossed. So it's great to see you again, Val. My gosh, it's been a long time. And as hockey will do, right? You play with the guys for a little while and then you don't see them again for 20 years.
But you know what we were talking about yesterday, and especially that I'm not in the hockey in the business or anything, so I'm kind of removed from all of this. But every time I see the guys, it's like we never left.
Yeah, totally like that. I mean, it's totally like that. Everywhere you go, it's awesome. And you had, I think maybe you talking about Moscow is a great place to start, because that's something that I don't know, even though that we played together for 3 years, is like, what brought you to North America? What brought you to Spokane? How was that decision made?
I think it was a family decision, because it was a time of our careers for my brother and I. As we know, you know, my brother Pavel, he was drafted and he just turned 20. So he wanted to pursue his career, and then the best league in the world still is National Hockey League. So he had opportunity to leave and play for Vancouver Canucks. He is about to sign a contract. So I came kind of with him, because I thought we were thinking if I would stay behind, that I probably would have a hard time to travel outside Russia. And they will not allow me to play for national teams or junior national teams, et cetera, et cetera. So it was a tough decision for me personally, because, you know, at 17 years old, right when before I came, I just made Red Army Club, which is typically top three lines or top two lines play for National Hockey League. You've been coached for Viktor Tikhonov. And so I was starting to season with them. And going from being playing with the professionals, leaving the country, and I did not even know where I was going to play. So we had no plan for me. We only had a plan for my brother. He's going. He's signing with Vancouver Canucks. And, you know, our agent at the time said, well, we'll find you some place to play. And that was kind of we made a decision as a family, like, hey, we all want to play in the National Hockey League one day, so let's move forward. This is probably our best option. But, you know, looking back, would it be better for me to continue to play another year or two with the Red Army and be coached by Viktor Tikhonov and just continue to develop my skills that way? Absolutely. But at the time, it was the best option as a family to leave together.
Gotcha. Yeah. So brave, you know, it's obviously new country, you know, like new language, new culture, new everything. And mom and dad like never came with you, if I remember correctly, right? You were straight into a billet house, right?
Correct. Yeah. I went straight into the billet house. And, you know, this, and I don't know if you know the full story behind it, how I came to Spokane. So my agent at the time was Aaron Salzer. And his best friend was with Bobby Brad. So he reached out to Bobby and he goes, Bobby, hey, listen, do you have a spot for the, you know, 17-year-old Russian kid? And he goes, how good is he? He goes, I don't know. I know his brother. He's about to play in the National Hockey League, but I never seen the younger brother. So I to be honest, I don't know. So Bobby said, okay, well, listen, I'll do a favor for my friend. So, because originally I was supposed to be somewhere either in Victoria, or at that time they did not have a team in Vancouver, but I was supposed to be a lot closer to my brother. So, but then when I came, it was a 7-hour away drive, and that's how I end up being in Spokane, playing with you and playing for Bobby. And, you know, it was a big shock, obviously, coming from Moscow. That's a big city, New York, you know, Chicago, all of those big cities, and coming in and in the to Spokane, not knowing the language, not have a friend. The only thing that, you know, I had is just to go and play hockey. So it was a culture shock. It was a language shock. It was everything in between. Obviously back then, you know, there were no cell phones, so I couldn't talk to my mom maybe once a week for a minute or two because it was very expensive to call. You know, I stayed with the Billets, and they took me and I felt part of the family. They were extremely kind to me, patient, generous. So that really helped, hospitality. And, you know, hockey guys is a hockey guys, you know, once you get into a dressing room, although you might not understand, but it's the same kind of environment. And, maybe I didn't understand the jokes in the beginning or whatever. So the first 6 months, I would say, was kind of a difficult. And then as my language kind of starting to get better, you know, it's easy it off in that sense. But I still miss my, you know, my parents, my my family, my friends, everything. So it took a while.
How did the how did you handle the language? Was it just by osmosis, like just by being around, or were you taking classes at the time?
It's basically just, you know, like our Billets will ask me something and I couldn't understand. You want a glass of water? I said, I don't know. So they literally fill up the glass with water. And this is, you know, glass, water, and fork, knife. And then the kind of, you know, as the time went on, my vocabulary became more and more. That's basically how I learned English. And up to even into this day, you know, my mom will ask me, hey, what can you translate this into Russian? And I can, because I learned just from English words. So that part was very difficult. And some of our older Russian people that came here, immigrants, they said, hey, you got to watch a lot of TV, just watch it. News, cartoon, whatever it is. And I did. And I'm like, I don't, why am I watching this? I can't understand one word because everybody speak fast. And, you know, and then a little by little, I'm like, oh, I can pick it up. Oh, I can figure it out. And then, and as the time went on, I start to understand more and more. But, you know, it's like, as you remember, our coach, you know, Maxie, is just, you know, screaming and yelling, divorce. I couldn't understand one word that he said. So, you know, except taps on the shoulder and you go on the ice. So, but it was fantastic. Like I said, everybody were so kind and patient. And after about a year of being, like, I started to be able to communicate and express myself a little bit more. So, and then I always want to, we had a goal to live in United States or North America in general. So actually when I was coming to Spokane, they offered us, do you want to stay with a Russian family or American family? And my first choice, I go, of course, Russian family. Like, at least I know the language. Then my dad at the time goes, no, listen, we came here to stay. So if we came here to stay, you have to learn the language. It's going to be hard, but that's what you got to do. So we did it, and he was right, 100%. I learned the language a lot quicker, and off we went. Yeah, but wild. You know what? My kids are still making fun of me about my accent or something that I say wrong words.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
But I said, hey.
Listening to you, I'm an admiration, because you mean really eloquent, great speaker, and obviously it's your second language, so I think you're doing just fine in my books, partner.
Yeah, thanks. I always tell my kids, I said, listen, you can't make fun of me because you speak only one language. When you're learning another language, whatever it is, then maybe we can make fun of one another. But for right now, no chance.
That's right. So 1992 was the year you got drafted. So you came over in your draft year, which obviously your dad was dialed in with, you know, Pavel and yourself into that hockey world. Was that part of the decision? Like, was it not very well scouted in Russia at the time? Did you feel that your draft position would maybe be better and get more eyes on you playing in the WHL?
Well, like I said, you know, I think I felt that my development would have been better in Russia. And at that time, you know, when I came, I didn't really play for any junior international levels. And junior international levels, when you play for junior national team, is a pretty high level, as you know. Whenever you play for Team Canada or whatever, and it's a great exposure. And although we have a lot of, you know, scouts pretty much on daily basis with Western Hockey League, it's a different exposure when you're playing for a national team, and it's a higher level. Mm-hmm. So, you know, would I change something? Sure. But, you know, the way it's worked out and the way the path took me, I absolutely loved it. You know, to play 72 games kind of prepared me to play in the National Hockey League, and mentally, physically, it's a grind. So, you know, no matter at what age you come into North America, if you play in a 50 games and all of a sudden you play 82, it's a big adjustment, and whatever it takes, a year or two. So, yeah. You know, it just from the development point of view, that's what I thought. And, you know, there's some guys that I played with, you know, including like, you know, Nazarov and Gonchar, that the Brilliant, they all my age. And at that time of my career, you know, I was superior of the player, and they went a lot higher of the draft with me. However, at the draft, you know, Vancouver told me, hey, if you're available, we will take you in the first round. Well, they didn't. And then the numbers go up and up and up and up, and I end up going 33rd, to Montreal. So, you know, not that I wish anything would be different, but it's, you know, it's a guess at this time.
Right.
Yeah.
If you look back to that year, you know, all the things you talked about, like coming over and being in a new country and all the rest of that, like there's massive amounts of adjustment. When I work with players now, like there's a massive amounts of adjustment just going from minor hockey to junior hockey, and you're being Canadian. You know what I mean? Like there's a big difference being away from home. So a lot of these guys are trying to deal with stuff. You dealt with stuff, you know, X-fold beyond that. As far as the hockey was concerned, you mentioned that was kind of your place. I mean, that was your place where you could go out. That's what you knew. That's what you were there for. Yet in the playoffs that year, you ended up having 11 goals in 10 games. Like, was that kind of where you started to feel like you, I don't know, whether you belonged in the league or felt comfortable or whatever the right way to put it was, but is that where you really felt like you started hitting your stride?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's what I, you know, what we mentioned earlier is, it just took me a while to get comfortable and understanding, and, you know, be able to communicate and actually just to relax. Before, you know, as much as I enjoyed hockey and loved, it's so different. And so your head is not really into that. And that's a difficult part, because you're struggling the whole day, basically mentally, because I miss my parents, I miss this. And then you put the gear on, and of course that goes away. You don't think about anything else but playing hockey, but you're not performing at your top level. And, you know, as a young kid, it's hard. As a pro, you still deal with it on a daily basis between family, friends, all of the environment, but you learn how to tune certain things out. As a young kid, you still not experience that, and it took me just a little bit of while to adjust. And by the time the playoff hit, you know, I'm already feeling loose and good, and that's kind of where my game started to turn around, but that I'd be able to really express on my talent and how I play on the ice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was awesome, because I remember, like, that was, I was there for that, and I'm sure you don't remember, but that your rookie year, I came in right at the very end of that year, and then played playoffs with you guys. So that's where I scored my first goals. And anyways, was watching you put the puck in the net too, and that was pretty fun part for me to remember that in the old Boone Street Barn and all the rest of it. How was that, the transition? And we now, you know, I want to talk about Maxi, because I think that I mean, that's something that we definitely share in his approach, and, you know, the way he would teach. And I want to contrast that with Tikhanov. But while it's on the top of my head, how was the physicality? Because, boy, the WHL was a tough league when we were playing in it. So, like, was that a big transition coming from Russia? Because I don't know what the game was like there, but was that a different element that you had to deal with and get accustomed to?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, when I came and I didn't play for the first, I want to say, 2 or 3 weeks because of the papers, and they just have to do the immigration, etc. And I watched it, and I looked at it, and I'm going, I don't think I'll be able to play in this. This is crazy. I mean, the guys are freaking warming up at a different time. There's a one team goes, they get in off, then another team goes. I go, why did they even go warm up? And then they said, no, it used to be crazy fights during the warm up, and then they start playing, and then it's like every 5 minutes there's a fight, there's a physical, and they didn't really care about the puck. Where, you know, you come in from Russia, it's all about puck possession. It, like, if you ever dump the puck in, you're going to be benched. There's just not it. It's puck possession. So you have nowhere to go find it. So it was completely different hockey game. And I remember my mom came to watch me playing for the first time, and my dad warned her. He says, hey, take a lot of, like, you know, relaxing, some kind of a pill, so you don't have to freak out, because this is not normal. And it was not normal. It was a crazy. And then watching it now, it's a completely different hockey game, obviously, and even the Western Hockey League or National Hockey League. But at the time, it was a big adjustment for me personally. It was obviously a lot smaller ice rink, so you're closer to everybody. But physicality of the game was pretty remarkable.
Yeah. And you, like, the one thing I remember about you, and I don't know how you remember yourself, but, like, you obviously weren't a fighter. You weren't a big guy. You were quick, and you were a goal scorer, and you were skilled. And that's what you were amazing at. But you had a little bit of nastiness to you, and you weren't shy to use your stick, and you weren't shy to stand up for yourself either. Was that something that was just naturally in you, or is that something that you had to kind of create to be able to survive really in the WHL?
Well, you just adjust as a hockey player. The skills and the level, obviously I was not a big guy, and my assets were speed and creativity. And it was fun in a sense, because as much as Maxi scream and yell and all of that stuff, he still allowed me to do what I wanted to do. And obviously it goes anywhere, as long as you do turn a puck over or you score more than you do turnover, they kind of close your eyes. So Maxi was great in that, and I just have to learn how do I not dump the puck, how do I not go in a certain position. And it would be harder when you look on the ice and you have a third line player with you that carries the puck, and all of a sudden I'm open and he dumps the puck. So again, to playing with those players taught me how to anticipate, how to understand that he's carrying it, he's not passing to me, he's going to dump the puck, and I got to go figure out where that puck is going to be and an angle. So I actually make him look good, because it looks like a puck was passed to me off the board, but it really wasn't. He had just had nowhere to go, and he dumped the puck. So all of those things, I think, makes you a better player, right? And I always say, listen, it's at any level, whatever it be, Western Hockey League or National Hockey League, there's only a few players that can really see you and pass the puck, and the rest of them, you have to adjust to who you play with. You have to, and I always feel the best players make other players better, not other way around. So you don't all of a sudden a good player and you expect everybody to pass it to you. You have to make everybody else better around you. And that's what makes great players great. And everybody likes to play with them other way around.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's a great point. And that is a special class, right? The guys that continue to elevate, their level stays the same, and everyone that seems to play with them has career years, right? Like that's a pretty special.
That's the best. Yes.
Yeah. So what about Max? So Maxi to Tikhanov, like, were they similar in their approach?
Teaching?
Yeah.
Like I said, yes and no. Like Tikhanov, his personality was great. I personally loved it. I love when the people scream and yell and get excited, because it's excitement comes with it. He's passionate, and that's how he drove everybody on the ice as well. There was a little bit of a teaching, but it's all like, let's go get it. Let's work hard. Let's just do it out there versus Tikhonov, very precise. He would not scream and yell. If he whispers to you on the ear, he was more as a teacher, very precise. He'll tell you exactly where to go, where to stand. It was developed as a system, and you stay in that system. There's not much of necessarily, I didn't want to say creativity, but once you get to certain positions, like, hey, let's creativity start. But before that, like when we play in a defensive zone, like there's just no room for errors. Like if you're standing 2 feet out of the way, hey, get back. So, but he's a great, great teacher. And that's what I was saying to you earlier. I think if I stayed back, he would continue to teach me and develop me, because something that not necessarily will come with me naturally, to be in certain positions to get a breakaways. You know, he worked with my brother to get a breakaways for the longest time, to receive the puck at the breakaways for the longest time. So it's an art. It's a skill, but it's an art that you also have to develop. And Maxi, I love it for different reasons. Like I said, he is, you know, he loves you or hates you, but he gives you hugs and he screams and yells and throws the sticks. And it was a completely opposite styles, but to be honest with you, what I would prefer, Maxi, because it's more fun to play. Right. But as far as the teaching and, you know, growing as a hockey player, I think Tikhonov is better. But both of them strict and very demanding.
Yeah, the one thing I remember about Maxi that he taught me was more the defensive side of the puck and in our zone. Like he definitely spent a lot of time on us on defensive positioning and where to be, and that was one thing that I remember he was pretty hard on me about was being in those positions, you know. And I did learn a lot from him. Like as far as you say, that'd have been amazing to play under Tikhonov. But even like in my NHL career and in my, you know, AHL career, like I probably learned the most in Spokane, at least from that aspect of the game, you know, positioning and stuff. And that was from Maxi, who definitely didn't mind yelling at me. That's for sure. And everyone else.
Well, but you know, to be honest, like if you think about it, when you get to NHL level, NHL coaches are expecting you to know those little things. Like you know, it's like that's something that you teach, like say Pee Wee, Bantam, Western Hockey League. By Western Hockey League, you're coming in, you should know certain things. So, yeah. And that's what I'm saying. In the Western Hockey League, the Maxi has the time. He has 2 hours and he could stop for an hour and we're not moving and he'll teach us where to stand. If you remember it, it would be that. You come to a National Hockey League, you play every other day. You have maybe 30 minutes or 35 minutes on the ice and we're moving on. The last thing as a coach, I'm thinking, I want to teach my pro guys how to be on the defensive side of the puck. It's right. Like, no, guys, that's kind of like ABCs. Yeah. Let's learn something different. Yeah. So that's always how I felt. By the time I shouldn't teach you how to shoot the puck in the National Hockey League. Yeah. So that's how I felt, like, hey, that's the Western Hockey League. That's Bantam. That's Pee Wee. And quite honestly, if you're looking at it, I coached my kids growing up. That's never been taught. That's never been taught in the junior level how to play properly.
I know.
And that's why I'm saying then you get to Western Hockey League and you look at the kids and you go, oh, my gosh, you don't know how to play hockey. How do you made it to Western Hockey League? And then from there, they get to a National Hockey League from there. And they're like, okay, let's get back to 10-year-old drills.
Yeah.
So
I couldn't agree more. Like, it's kind of crazy, like, watching, you know, some of these teams now, like, there's just not much structure in the defensive zone for sure, I think. I mean, the offensive zone is a much different game. There's more skill and pace. But defensively, it's crazy. It's like almost everybody forgot to teach them, or like there's no responsibility to it, which is maybe why goals are up too. But anyways, we won't get into that.
Well, but if you remember, I mean, I don't know if you're watching it or not, but it's like, you know, there's no stops and starts, period. There's nobody stopping these days. So it's like, and I don't know, maybe if you stop, you're out of, you know, you're not going on offense as fast, obviously. So but you know, I love the game. This, the way the stages it in, it's goals are going, it's exciting, but it's just a different game.
Just going to take a short break from my discussion with Valeri To remind you guys that the 2024-25 season is approaching. And what do I mean by that? Well, I mean that if you're a parent or if you are a coach or a general manager, or if you're a head of an association or a president of an association or an academy, that planning starts happening now for that season. And I know that the dues are being set and what the programming is going to look like. And I just want to remind you that Up My Hockey can be a full service provider for mindset and personal development for your association. It is becoming much more in vogue, much more understood that mindset and personal development is the absolute missing link in a lot of programs, that we need to step outside just the physical development and the physical programming and give these players the strategies, tools, concepts, perspectives to be high performers. High performance does not happen only when you step on the ice. It's an approach, right? It's the way your thoughts align with your dreams and your goals. It's your ability to handle adversity. It's your mental toughness when things start going the way you maybe didn't envision them going. And there are ways to help athletes through this. And this is something that I've seen now in the 4 to 5 years now that I've been working with hockey players with their personal development, with their thought processes, with their ability to be resilient, that confidence can be grown. Confidence can be taught. And not only can it be taught on an individual level, but when you apply it to a team, the team can create a culture of resilience and less problems happen during a season. There's so many benefits about giving your players the tools to invest in themselves that if you don't have something like that where you are playing hockey right now, then I highly suggest that you put them in contact with Up My Hockey and we can have some conversations to see what that'll look like for the 24-25 season. Lots of things to be excited about. There's been some really great success stories this season with teams and programs that have taken the services of Up My Hockey and myself and the coaching, and people have seen great gains. I would love to share those stories with somebody that is interested. So by all means, reach out to Up My Hockey at upmyhockey.com is a great place to reach out for a contact form, or Jason at upmyhockey.com. You can reach out to me directly with interest for the upcoming season. Now let's get back to my conversation with Valeri Burre. And yeah, I mean, I don't know how you feel, but one thing I have said in this before is like to score goals, whether it was the NHL in the 90s or in the WHL in the 90s, like you took some bruises to do that a lot of the time. You know, like you had to get into hard areas. It was not easy to get there. And when you got there, you had to be brave enough to put it in the net. And I just don't see quite that level of commitment to scoring now, you know, that you have to be. So, you know, credit to you being, you know, 5'11 in your day and not the heaviest guy, and to put up the numbers that you did. I know how proud of my numbers I am in that scenario. You know, I can imagine that you must have some pride too, because it wasn't easy, man. Like you had to go in there because you knew you were taking some lumber somewhere.
You were taking a beating. I remember one of the coaches asked me to go stand in front of the net. And I'm like, that's not standing. It's like getting a cross check. You get up, you get cross check again, you get up. And that was legal. It's not like it was illegal. It's just, that's what it is. And I'm like, oh my gosh, this is not pleasant. what am I doing? You know, but then now it's great. The guys just stand, no matter what size you are, you just stand, nobody can touch, and it's just deflections and it's beautiful. But, you know, in between the holdups, you know, I had to get it at the National Hockey League level. There's every year I had to be fixed. Either would be my shoulders, my knees, my hips, whatever it is. So it's a part of the business. I get it. But it was, you know what I miss these days, tell you the truth, and we'll move on to something different if you want, but it's those middle ice hits. Like when the guy's coming across the blue line and I'm closing my eyes and I'm kind of going like this. I'm like, somebody's going to hit them, and nobody does. And there's a, you know, Trouba or somebody will step up once in a while. And I'm like, what a great hit. And I miss those hits. Not that I want to get anybody to get hurt, but it's such a great part of the hockey that I truly miss, whatever it was, Kasparaitis or, and I told, you know, my kids, I'm like, when I stepped on the ice, I knew exactly who was out there. I knew it was, you know, Stevens is on the ice. I better keep my head up. I can't come across the blue line or Gasparitis. As soon as I get the puck, he is coming at me. Yeah. So my head is always like this. And now the guy is just willing, which is fantastic. They're healthier and all of that stuff. But I do miss those, you know, a good legal hits.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, it's a fun part of the game. It definitely keeps you, like I said, it keeps you more aware. Now it's like the onus is on, seems like the onus is on the guy without the puck to make sure the guy with the puck knows that he's there. Like it's almost, it's crazy, right? Like back in our day, it was always like the guy with the puck, you had to know what was going on.
Yeah.
Anyway, so that responsibility seems to have switched. One thing I wanted to ask you, just as far as playing in Russia before you came over, I remember you would do... Geez, I've even showed my kids, Val, which you probably think is funny, but there was like a routine you would do in the gym with the easy curl bar, and mm-hmm. and you would do bicep curls, and you would push it over your head, and then you would do the triceps, and there was another one that you threw in there. Well, you did the wrist curls too. And anyways, you had some routines that you would do, and even with the jumping, some plyometric stuff that you would do that nobody else was really doing. And obviously, mm-hmm. you were successful and you were quick and you were somebody that I saw doing that and would try to, imitate what you were doing. Where did that all come from? Was that from dad? Was that from the environment? Was, you know, share that with me about your work ethic and the things you would do.
Well, number one, I'm still doing those exercises, believe it or not. It's like, I thought I would never do it. My kids didn't know how to do it. But it is, I don't know if you know, but my dad was an Olympic swimmer. So he was in the 68, 72, 76 Olympic Games. And that work ethic definitely comes from him. Attention to details, all of those explosive exercises and plyometrics. And, you know, people always say, well, your brother was so fast. And I said, no doubt about it. But amount of work that he put in to be fast, nobody sees it. You know, his legs and everything has been built. It's not just God-given gift. There was for sure a gift, but he developed all of those stuff. So do I. I worked a lot on, you know, on my quickness. And even at that day, my dad figured it out. He goes, listen, the most goals are scored in the second part of your shift, because if you go at first 30 seconds, everybody's fresh. He goes, then it's a turnover or something, and you look at the guy, and he's been on the ice for 30, 40 seconds there. His legs are shot, and you've been on the ice because you're changing almost at the same time. So that's where you got to be fresher than him, faster than him, and get going. It's not about how much weight. And back then, it's like, hey, I can bench press X amount. What does it matter? Can you skate faster, or can you VO2 max will be better? So recovery, all of that stuff. So he figured that out very quickly. And that's what we focused on. We focused on speed, and that comes all from my dad. And we focused on, you know, can you continue to have that speed outburst in your 45 seconds to a minute 15, you know, because it's your legs are heavy. So we train purposely for that. So we ran a long distance on the sand. We trained in LA, and then we did a lot of plyometrics, then explosiveness, then sprints. And then my dad actually developed same thing later on in his career onto the ice. So everything kind of had been developed, and now a lot of teams, a lot of people learn that, and they start to adjust into that style of training.
Awesome. That's really exciting. I'd love to dive deeper on that, maybe offline at some point. I got young players now that are going through it, and everyone has kind of their, you know, their idea or their take on what is going to make you successful. But boy, you and Pav were obviously real quick and real agile, and seemed like to be a step ahead at the time. So I'm sure your dad, Vladimir, right? Was that your dad's name?
Vladimir, yeah.
Yeah, had something dialed in there. That's pretty exciting.
Well, you know, I had two kids, and one of them, well, I still have, but I mean, one of them was really big, and another one is smaller. And obviously a smaller guy, his limbs move a lot quicker, but the bigger guy, and that's the idea, is can I make the bigger one to fire those muscles and those small twitch muscles go faster? And that's the idea of, yes, if I can do this, then it becomes almost unstoppable. So, but you got to work on that. It's not natural for anybody. You know, there's only certain people, maybe 1% have that natural ability to fire the muscles quick. The rest of the people don't have that. So there goes a lot of work on a daily basis to learn how to fire them and translate into their eyes.
Right. Is that something that you're still like, were you passionate about that with your kids growing up? Were you trying to help them?
I said, listen, you know, I'm here. I'll help you. But I cannot put the work for you. So I'm available anytime. And, you know, they are my kids, to be honest. I mean, growing up in LA, growing up, you know, in the Southern California, they're just soft. They're just soft. They're great people. I love them. They're much better, you know, human beings than I am. But it's harder. It's harder to have that hunger. Because, you know, you step on the ice, you have to compete.
Yeah.
And it hurts. It hurts. You have to compete against your friend, or you have to compete, I guess, maybe the guy that you don't want, but you got to go in the corner and come out with a puck. And it's not always pretty, you know, and they just want to be friends and kind of have fun and enjoy. And they were both, you know, very good at how they played. But as far as a drive, as far as, you know, work ethic, you know, it's another level to be going to Western Hockey League, college, and National Hockey League. It takes a special mentality, special people to get there. And I always say, you know, if everybody could do it, they would. But it's a unique club to get into a National Hockey League, because it's a very hard to do.
Yeah, you said it. That's one of the biggest pieces, right? Like, how bad do you want it? What are you willing to do to get there? You know, and that's why it's kind of fun when I'm still involved in the game and I'm working with athletes, you know, at all lots of different levels. And it's exciting when you do see that passion and that fire. You know, I think you can also like nurture it and grow it. But when it comes from a natural spot where this is what they want to be, you know, not just play hockey, I say, but to be a hockey player.
Right.
I think there's two different levels there, and you definitely need that piece between the ears to get it done.
And I always say, Jay, you know, even if you have that, that's still not a guarantee that you're going to make it. You can have all the pieces in the world and all of that stuff, and there's still things like, you know, injuries, or there's, you just never know. But you got to give yourself a best chance at success, and maybe you'll make it. You know, yeah. But that's a true story. I mean, listen, yeah. Of course, you know, there's a superstars and all of that stuff, but listen, I played with the guys that were maybe better than me. They never made it to National Hockey League, or they played not very much, you know. So it's not a guarantee thing that you're going to be there, but to give yourself a best chance, hey, you know, I always look at the guys next to me and I said, hey, I'm going to work harder than you, and I'm going to work harder than you. The work ethic should be, there's no question. That's a mentality that you should have. That I remember some friends of mine in the summer, they'll be like, hey, so, you know, let's go play golf this afternoon. And I said, I don't have time to play golf. I have a workout in the morning. I go eat meal, take a rest, and I have another workout. I work out twice a day. I said, what golf are you talking about? And, you know, those guys that played golf, they never made to National Hockey League.
Right.
So that's the choices that we make. It's like, hey, that's a dedication. I want to be the best that I can be.
Right. Yeah, I know. That's impressive. How was it as far as, you know, so Pavel was older. I'm not going to say he was better when he was younger, but I mean, at the end of the, you know, 60 goals in the NHL and kind of a household name. Was it hard or did you feel like you were in his shadow? Like, how was that having that older brother and how successful Pav was in the NHL and right from the get-go pretty much?
You know, growing up, we were always competitive. Obviously, it's a kid's, hey, you know, I score this many goals, how many goals you score, and all of that stuff. And not that we were making fun, but we were very competitive. And then as you get older and you get more mature, you're starting to understand how hard it is to do what we do. He never made me feel like I was in his shadows at all. He's always praised me, and he goes, hey, listen, you know, you were a very good player on your own, of course. And so we were never competitive in that end. But of course, it's like dealing either with media and all of that stuff. Never made me feel bad or by any means, because I had a support not only from my family but from my brother, who was a superstar. You know, he's always, like I said, he always uplift me. I said to the media many times, I said, they said, well, are you on the shadow? I said, you compare me to one of the best players in the world. What shadow? I score 30, 20, 25 goals in the National Hockey League. I'm a pretty decent player. So, but you compare me to a guy that scores 60. I said, okay, I'm okay with this comparison. You're not comparing me to the guy that is playing in the minors or, you know, somewhere in Europe. So I said, I'm in a pretty good shape. But like I said, you know, we always, as especially as older we got and we played a few years in the league, it's, you know, it was more of the support system rather than competitiveness or jealous about how many goals, you know, he scored or anything like that. So he made me feel very good about that.
That's cool. Yeah, he was, yeah, you know, he was obviously an electric player and he was fun to watch, as were you. And I think that's, it's nice when you're rooting for each other, of course. And it sounds like you guys were tight and probably still are. So that's nice to see. Yeah. I got the brothers right now. I don't have the brothers. I should say I have the sons right now. Three boys that are like, what are they, 45 months between all three of them. So they're tight, close in age, they all play hockey, and although they are friends, they also do battle, you know, and we're seeing more of the battle side right now. So I'm waiting for the mature side that you're talking about to start showing up here. We'll see.
You know, my kids are 26, 24 and 22, and that my maturity level just starting to kick in, just starting to, like, okay, you know, before is always a fighting and all of that stuff. And I'm, you know, I'm like, hey, you know, one day you'll become a best support system for one another. And I think it's just coming over. We're over the hill.
I noticed that I don't have the year written down, but you played in the World Junior Championship for Russia there, before you went pro, and you actually led that team in scoring. So, was that kind of cool to come, you know, to North America, you're playing WHL, now you get selected by your home country to go play with the best, you know, junior players of their age in Russia on a world stage, and you turn out to lead that team in points. Was that homecoming kind of a nice, I don't know what you say, validation of where you were and what you had accomplished overseas?
It was just good time for me to go and play with the friends of mine. Like I said, I grew up with them. We got drafted the same time. I always feel good about my ability and, you know, how I play and where I am, my development and all of that stuff. Because, you know, Bobby never was happy when I left and play it at the any kind of international levels. You know, he wants me always be with the Spokane Chiefs. So I'm like, Bobby, I get to play either for juniors or following year I play for with the national team a few tournaments. And, you know, Bobby was sour. I still talk to Bobby and I go, Bobby, I can't believe you were sour. He's like, yeah, well, it was not good for you to go play. So, but that felt good to go and be with the guys, you know, that we spoke the same language, kind of same thing. The guys that I grew up with, like Sergei Brilin, he was my centerman for probably 10, 15 years, since 6 to right before I left, we played together. So that part was great. And then, you know, to be able to be a leader, not only on the ice, but off the ice, that felt really good to be and going, yes, I have developed into that player that everybody expect me to be. So that it was a good validation in that sense.
Yeah, that's fun. You mentioned the draft, and I should ask about that, because it sounds like I had a little bit of a similar experience, and it's so funny, right, back in the day, like what we would talk about or not talk about, you know. But you know, that we weren't, I don't remember in Spokane, like having discussions about that, the draft and what it was like. And, you know, and even though you're doing it the next year on your own, we kind of didn't have those types of conversations. But what was you were supposed to, or thought you were going to go in the first round to Vancouver, be with your brother, potentially, like super exciting. That doesn't happen. And then you said, like, you sat there and you waited and you waited and you waited. Walk me through that and what that was like mentally for you.
Yeah, it was, you know, it was obviously new to everything. It was in Montreal. So we had our greatest time. That's a great city. So we sat on the stands, and I was projected to go mid first round. You know, interviews were not as in depth as they are today. I understand, but my brother was already with Vancouver, and they said, "Hell, it would be a great fit for both of you to be there." You know, they obviously watched me quite a bit in Spokane and Victoria and all of that stuff. So I'm totally expecting. So my dad's sitting next to me, and Vancouver comes up, and they don't choose me, and we're kind of looking at one another like, what just happened? So then, literally, as the players get picked, I'm get passed, and I believe it was a 30 teams at the time, 29 or 30. So first round is over, and obviously, you know, we're surprised and devastated. So my dad looks at me, and he just leaves. He was a smoker at that time. He just left, and he goes, "Screw this. This is terrible." And he left. So when he left, Montreal called my name, and I got drafted at the 33rd overall. And it was nice. I actually got a great reception right there. Fans cheered and all of that stuff. But you know, it's still your expectation to go first round, middle, and then you get passed by 15 players. It's surprising. It's kind of less, but at the end of the day, you know, you feel, and you then later you understand that, you know, maybe top five, maybe top seven players, certain caliber, and the rest of them, you got to fight for your spot. So no matter if you know, 33rd or you're 75th, you're going to be in the training camp, and you get to get same opportunities, same looks as anybody else, and you got to go and earn it. And that's the part that you understand, that you've got to show up and fight.
Yeah.
And later on, it's just like I said, I play with the guys that have been drafted in the top 10, and they never made it to National Hockey League because they think, "Hey, I got drafted. Obviously, in the top 10 is a big deal." They stop working, and the guys that have been drafted, you know, second, third, fourth, fifth round, work extra hard, and they just outperform and outcompete them. And that's, unfortunately, that's happened. So it's, you know, people always say, "Hey, it's hard to make to NHL. It's even harder to stay there." Because when sometimes, "Hey, you know, I made it. This is National Hockey League. That's it. What do I do?" But you quickly realize, oh my gosh, that is just the beginning. That's just the, you know, tip of the iceberg. You need to get going, and you need to work hard, because everybody want to take your job away, and it's not given. You know, your power play doesn't score, you off the power play, next power play unit goes on, all of a sudden you're not on a power play. So you're always going to be, and I like that part. That's what taught me in general in life. That is, you know, although you're trying to be on top of whatever business you're in, you need to always look over your shoulder and get going. You always have to run.
Yeah. You, as far as I remember, and again, it has been quite some time, but in comparison, especially to the other Russians that I played with, like kind of a straight and narrow kind of guy. Like you weren't a guy at the team parties that, you know, are running around with smokes in your mouth and beers and stuff. Like you always kind of seemed to have this business-like professional approach to you. And a little bit, like I say, even unlike some of maybe like your countrymen. I hate to put some people in a basket, but like I played with a lot of Russians that like to run real hard. You know, they would smoke and they would drink, and that was,
Sure.
seemed to be part of maybe that national you know, psyche kind of. But you seem to be different. Like, was that something from your dad, just you in general? Like you always sort of seemed to know what you wanted and with the best way to get there.
Well, it's you know, not that at that time, you know, this is what I want to do, but I also realized that, for example, if I do something like this, then my body is not performing. Again, back then, you know, I'm a 5'10, 165, 168 pounds, and I'm competing with 6'2, you know, 220. I'm already in disadvantage before we even step on the ice. I'm already disadvantaged. So if they don't feel well or they don't move as well, hey, they put the stick on me or they outweigh me, they outmuscle me. So I always have to be fresh. I always have to be on top of the game. So if we go out and we, you know, party or whatever, all of a sudden I'm the one who's going to be left behind. So I understood my part of the and where I stand. It sounds good maybe to go out once in a while, whatever, but I understand also that my body will not perform as good as I want it to. So I have to be very focused in that sense. And it's funny you mentioned that because, you know, when I played in Florida, I had a friend and we both into a wine and he goes, you know, it's not fun to be around you when you're playing hockey. He goes, the best time is when you were hurt and then you'd be able to enjoy a glass of wine. I said, well, listen, wait, it's my job. Well, what can I do? I said, you know, I have to be focused on it. So and it goes with, you know, where probably we come from. There's people do like to enjoy and have fun and all of that stuff. And I do like to have fun as well. It's just, you know, I can't afford to do certain things.
Right. When you made the move from Spoke to Montreal, obviously I don't know exactly whether you made the team out of camp or not, but you split time between the NHL and the AHL that year. And it looked like you definitely earned your spot. You know, I mean, it wasn't an easy league, the AHL, to perform. You had a point of game there as your first year pro, scored almost like a, you know, 50 goal pace clip. And then you were never back to the AHL. So like, well, how was that for you? Like that transition of becoming a pro and learning the pro game and showing people that, you know what, I'm an NHLer and I'm here to stay.
Well, it's a very interesting concept because out of the gate, when I got drafted by Montreal Canadiens, my dad said to me, he goes, hey, I learned very quickly, whatever you do, do not sign two-way contract. Just don't do it. If it's a two-way contract, if something comes in, they look at it, and if you're a better player, you get sent down. So I said, okay. So we kind of hold off, and after a year playing in Western Hockey League and being drafted by Montreal Canadiens, we're negotiating the deal and there was no deal. So I said, there's no problem. I play another year in Spokane anyway. I'm going to go back to the draft. So I was preparing it to do this because again, I'm playing in the Western Hockey League anyway. What does it makes a difference? If I was in the National Hockey League, maybe. So then later I was a first guy in Montreal Canadiens history to sign a 1 year deal. One-way deal from juniors. So then the following year, I come to the training camp and it was a lockout. So there's a few of us that kind of made the club and they come up to us and go, hey, it's a lockout. You got to go to the minors. And I go, no, I'm an NHL player. You told me I made the team. Why do I have to go to the minors? And they like, well, we don't want you to sit around. You don't have anywhere to play. On top of this, you're on a one-way deal. You're going to get your money. But my ego was like, hey, well, I don't care about money. I'm not about money. I want to play in the National Hockey League. So they go, no, you don't understand. Go develop, have fun, play. So at the time, again, it was a smart decision by them. There's no question about it. I came, we had a quite an amazing team there. Our coach was amazing. And again, it took the step for me to go. It's a big difference from Western Hockey League into being a pro. Again, waking up and you don't have a billets. You know, the practice is over. You can do whatever you want. You want to party, you want to do whatever it is. You're free. Yeah. You don't have necessarily, you know, remember with Maxie, we have to check in the morning. There's no check-ins. There's no nothing. So it was a great adjustment for me. And we had, you know, about 7 or 8 guys that made the National Hockey League club, but they were sent down. You know, Bellado, Turner Stevenson, me, Wilkes. There's a few guys on that team. It was a great team. So we went down there and played. And interesting enough is when season started, they called up a few guys, but they did not get me back. And it took them about, you know, 2 weeks or 3 weeks. And then, you know, Montreal is great that way. And I respect that every single player that came out of juniors always went to a minors to play, whatever it be. But, you know, I know Patrick Roy went, everybody went for a month, two, three. And it's kind of a step. Hey, you got to learn how to get there, because what they don't want to do is get you back to NHL and then send you back down and go back up to NHL. So they want you to grow, mature, because it's a different level. Not any, everybody can handle that. And then once you make it, you go on. And that's what happened with me. I felt very comfortable, very confident as a player in AHL. And I put up some good numbers. And when I moved up, it was still adjustment in NHL. But that was a move.
Just going to take a short break from the conversation with Valeri to remind you that the Peak Potential Hockey Project is my signature program that has now been graduated by over 300 athletes. And the guided mission of the Peak Potential Project is the most popular way to take the program. The guided mission means you join a small group of athletes and I guide you through it. We have coaching calls weekly after a week of content, and we get together to discuss, and we get together to make sure that the information is being applied by your hockey player specifically, making sure that we get through any challenges, share some success stories, and dive deeper into the content. And in 30 days, it's amazing some of the transformations that I get to witness and that the players see in themselves. It's a ton of fun. Transformations obviously happen when a player is coming into the program with lower confidence, when they are feeling not as brave and courageous on the ice as maybe they should, when their confidence is a little bit lower and they're giving away the puck and maybe they're not taking care of their practice habits the way they should. Players like that can have amazing transformations in 30 days. They start connecting the dots differently. They start creating different stories and ideas about what mistakes mean. They start feeling less intimidated by the thoughts and opinions of other people, and they can play with a type of courageousness that they haven't seen before. And these are the types of stories where players or parents come up to other parents and say, "What happened to Jimmy? What happened to Johnny? What'd you do? What's the difference?" And it is that tangible that it can be seen in the course of a weekend or in the course of a couple weeks. And if your player isn't somebody that is experiencing low confidence or is experiencing a scenario where they're second guessing themselves, and they're rolling along well, or maybe they're even performing well, the program is still for you, as every ounce of percentage points uptick, every advantage that we can give our players to connect the dots, to be able to buy into their own personal development, to understand and empower them in situations where they can make new choices and have different decisions. This is a no-lose scenario. So if you have not looked at mindset development before, if you've not thought about personal development for your hockey player, I highly suggest that you get involved with it. It's one of those things that no one has ever come to me and said, "Geez, I wish we didn't do this." They've only said, "Oh, I wish we didn't do this sooner. I don't know what we were waiting for." So don't wait, right? The time is now. This is something that you will be happy that you got involved in. Your player will be glad that they participated in it. And this is something that can be a starting point and a growth point for the rest of their hockey careers, for sure. And definitely something that they will use for the rest of their life. So the Peak Potential Hockey Project, the mindset training that I developed for hockey players of all ages, is available at any time. The guided mission is something that is a recurring, revolving launch. So there might be one available right now. Maybe I'm going to be in a program right now and you're listening to this. Neither here nor there. You can check out the next availability at www.upmyhockey.com and get involved in the mental training for your hockey player. Now let's get back to the conversation with Valeri Burry. What a brilliant maneuver there, though, with the one way, like completely brilliant.
Incredible.
And so can you walk? So that was from your dad again, more than your agent? Yeah.
Yes. Well, you know what? I mean, not to bash on the agents, but you know, they're looking to make as much money as they can put in a pocket, and it's a business. I totally understand. So that my dad learned very quickly. You know, there's a one guy, you know, on a one way making, say, you know, $500,000, but he's on a one way, and another guy is at the million in a two way, and they kind of the same. Well, they're going to send down the guy that makes in a million to save $500,000. It's just a business. It's a math. There's nothing personal. So my dad figured that out. So I had actually later on in my career, you know, GMs will come to me because they're negotiating the deal with the Russian guys, and you know, Russian guys will be like, "Hey, I want $1 million," and he goes, "Hey, I will give $1 million. It's going to be a two-way deal, but he's going to be making $75,000. I guarantee you that." Because if he takes 300,000 or 400,000 one way, he will be NHL player. He will be seen by all the scouts in NHL, and his career will start. Yeah. But the guys go, "No, I want $1 million. Well, you get what you deserve. Here's $1 million. Season starts. You go down to the minors, and that's it. So it's a business. It's a math. It's the way to understand. So of course, if you're a superior player by far, maybe you end up staying, but my dad figured that out, and you know, I'm thankful for him. And I was trying to teach a lot of younger players as well. It's like, hey, listen, if you're good, you'll make your money.
So did you take less then, like from what you're saying there, like a smaller one way is kind of what you decided on? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And did that correlate into a smaller signing bonus too? Were you worried about that?
Listen, I don't know if you remember. I mean, I signed whatever my signing bonus was. I got a brand new car. I went and bought the Mitsubishi sports car. I was driving in Spokane, and like a guy from Russia coming and getting some money has a new car. Are you kidding me? It was a dream come true. What else can I expect? So I don't even remember quite honestly what was the different options, except yes, the salary was down. But again, it's a guarantee money, right? I'm going to get paid.
Yeah.
And I'm going to be hopefully in a National Hockey League, because again, they don't want to pay me X amount of dollars playing in AHL.
Right. That is, that's crazy. Cause I was looking, it's funny. Cause like I went like our pair, like it's so crazy. Like our connection in a lot of senses, like I went 31st in the second round, like fifth pick. And then our first year too, as 20-year-olds, because that was when I was up and down too, my first year, except I was on a two-way. And I had, 46 points in 39 games, and I had 21 goals in the minors that year, right? So like real similar stats, but never got through to your point of like getting there, right? It was always like, okay, I would get called up, but then sent down because I was the easy guy to send down, right? Because then you'd have Jody Hall, or you'd have whoever who had been in the league for 5-6 years on a one-way deal. And, you know, like,
that's my point.
What are you doing to make yourself that much more attractive, right? And anyways, I guess I never found the way to be that much more attractive, and it was always the easy guy to move.
But it's an easy answer is you had to score 80 goals to make yourself more attractive. I always say, you know, to take somebody's job in the National Hockey League or somewhere, you can't be as good as him or a little bit better. You got to be a head above. You got to, because as a coach or as a GM, I got to look and go like, you give me no choice but get this guy because he's that much better. But if, like you said, if you got a Jody Hall that is on a one-way deal and he's same numbers as you, well, guess what? You in the minors and he's not.
Yeah.
And so it is a hard business to be in, but it's a fair. You just got to be better and making the right decisions as far as contracts go, you know.
Yeah, and what would that? So that would have been you re-entering the draft if they don't give you that one way. You were prepared to go back in the draft and get drafted wherever you were, and hopefully whatever get a one way from the next player, next guys up.
Yeah, I mean, you were hoping to go. Yeah, it's not that I wanted not to play for Montreal Canadiens. Again, it was just a smart thing on my part that my dad realized and making the smart decisions because, hey, I want to play in the National Hockey League, and Montreal is a fine place. But if we can't come to terms, then, yeah, I was preparing to go back to the draft because I believe the rules were, you know, you're after 2 years of not signing, you become a free agent, then you go back to the draft. So, I was not good enough to play as a 18 or 19 year old, and I was back to playing in Spokane. So I'm like, well, what's the purpose? So I do get my bonus. I either drive a new car or I don't drive a new car. It's not a big deal. Yeah. But it's a big deal on how are you approaching and moving forward with your career. And like I said, I'm thankful that it was not my agents, but my family advised me very correctly and wise.
Right. Yeah. And then your first full year, you scored 20, I mean, in the show, which is fantastic. And then 14.
Not compared to my brother. It's not fantastic.
Yeah, I'm done talking about yeah. Pavel. But 20 is great, obviously. We both know that 21 is a 20 yeah. as a 21 year old is a fantastic number. I know that you took pride in your goal scoring. You know, you could definitely pass sure. the puck too, but you enjoyed putting the puck in the net. Then the next year, your numbers go down. The next year, they go down a little bit more. Like, mm-hmm. was there some transitioning there issues? Was there some ice time issues? How did that walk with you? Because then you end up moving to Calgary shortly thereafter.
You know, it's a combination. It's a combination of not us as us. I'm saying is us as Montreal Canadiens not playing well. There's a coach is changing. There's something always come in. You know, at some point, I remember I was getting dressed as a, you know, 13th forward and playing only a power play. That's it. So I would sit for a period and a half if there's no power play, and then a power play comes in and he goes, okay, you go on power play. So there's, you know, this, it's just, I don't know why or what, but the things just didn't work out as that sense. And obviously at that point as well is, you know, you have the guys that are making more money or superior have been older than me and they ahead of me, the trades that we make and, you know, for me to make, a statement, I somehow had to step on the ice if I even had a 5 minutes of playing time and score the goal and continue to earn my spot. And, you know, I clearly didn't. And that cost that because, you know, how do you go from scoring 20 and playing, you know, on the second line or first line into scoring a lot less goals and not playing as much. And then there was a couple injuries in between. You know, there was a couple concussions, which is hard to get back from. That's what I felt the hardest. It's not the injury. It's coming back and missing 4 or 5 games. And then once you miss that time, it's just it takes another 4 or 5 games to get back into swing at things. So it's just the one thing led into another. And, you know, I really never was a healthy scratch necessarily. And the first healthy scratch I was, I got traded.
Oh, okay. That's when you got went over to Calgary.
Yeah.
How was that? Do you feel like as a player and advocating for yourself? So, I mean, you said you went from, you know, 22 and on the first or second line to all of a sudden, like down to this scenario where you're only playing power play. Were you in the coach's office asking why, what you needed to do? Like, what was the communication like back then? And how did you advocate for maybe more minutes?
Yeah, it was a lot of communications, obviously, you know, and some coaches, I don't think they were as honest as I want them to be because they're like, no, everything's good. And I'm like, well, everything's good, but why am I not playing? Well, you know, so, like I said, you know, earlier, talking about like Brian Maxwell yell and scream at you and grab you and tell you exactly what he thinks and what he wants from you, and then you get to National Hockey League and it's more political and it's mm-hmm. more, oh well, but I gotta take care of this, but I gotta take care of this. So but again, you know, I can only blame maybe myself that I did not perform to the level that they expect probably 30-40 goals from me at that point and continue to develop. So there's of course, you know, listen, as a player coming young, scoring 20 goals, you're slamming the sticks, you're getting pissed off in the dressing room, you're of course all of that stuff goes into it. I can't say that I was extremely happy going to the rink knowing that you're not playing or you playing as a 13th forward. You're furious, and the guys see that and all of that stuff. So it was difficult, but by no means that I ever wanted to get traded from there or be moved. So the first move and first trade came to me as a surprise.
Right. And then you get there, and I was actually just doing a tiny bit of research before we got on the call, and I would assume you would agree that it was your best 3 years in the NHL were with the Calgary Flames there. You know, 1, 2, 3 years in a row where, you know, you put up 26, 35, 27 as far as goals are concerned. You led the Calgary Flames in scoring. And just for everyone listening, like, keep in mind, this is while Jerome Iginla was there. And I looked at the numbers from those 3 years. You guys both scored 88 goals in the three seasons you were there. So you tied, you know, future Hall of Famer Jerome Iginla, Mr. Calgary Flame, you know, during your time there, and actually led the team in points. Like, that must have, when you're looking back on your career, I assume that must be a pretty positive point for you.
It was definitely, you know, again, I stayed somewhat healthy during those 3 years. You know, our coach was Brian Sutter at the time, who was, you know, you can either love or hate him. He is very vocal and outgoing, and you know, so we remind me of Brian Maxwell. So that was, it was a fun to play. We had a great young group that, you know, from Iginla to Domenicali, Stillman, all of those great, Housley and Savard and all of those. So we were all the same age. Actually, Iginla was, you know, my roommate for 3 years that I was there. Oh, so yeah, so it was fun. I mean, we had a, you know, it's not very often, but back then, obviously you had to share the room with a roommate, and him and I were on a perfect schedule that we loved sleeping afternoon and we were go to sleep early. So there was just an excellent. So him and I, we had a great times together. And again, we were competitive in the sense of, you know, he wants to score more goals than I do, and we're playing a power play and all of that stuff going. So it was a great years. You know, the thing is, what I was disappointed the most, because we're a young team coming in and to our own, and we're always battling with Edmonton or whatever. We're never made it into the playoffs, and they pulled the plug a year or year and a half too early. They did not give us a chance to really grow into it. And we were, you look at the team, we're all developing as a team, young guys, and they just were not patient enough, and they pulled the plug, and then the team kind of dissipates until the later years. That was kind of a sad part for me. I was sad to see that, you know, I was getting traded, and other people were getting traded as well.
Right. One thing, and I don't know if it's anything or not, but it looked like you had an assistant captain in the 2000 season that you were labeled as one of the leaders. And then the following year you didn't. And there was also a coaching change there. So did you have an A and then it was removed when the new coach came in, or is there anything to that at all?
Yeah, you know how it goes. It's a new coach comes in and he has different ideas of, you know, who he wants to be. And that's a hard part about it. Like I said, it, you know, the coaching changes is always hard on the players. It's a new system, new, you know, that coach had, you know, Iginla and Domenicali and all of those guys in Kamloops, and he knows them. So he's automatically draws into them and puts him, and the A was removed from me and moving forward. So I'll tell you, that obviously did not feel good, but you're still, you know, I always say, you know, you're professional. You can argue, disagree, whatever. Once you're on the ice, you don't think about it, not scoring goals or not being as successful as a team. So, yeah. It was a different year. There's no question about it. But we still, I feel that we were still performed fairly well. And like I said, we were moving and growing as a team.
Right. I'm just going to ask you another question about that, because I think that there's a big human element to that, right? Like, that one guy recognizes you as being, you know, a leader of men at the NHL level. And that was the first time you had an A, and then this new guy comes in and decides that you're not that player anymore. How was that communicated? If at all? I know it was a different coaches communicate different ways. And was there any FUs back? Like, was that something that you got, like, behind closed doors, excited about, mad about?
Definitely not excited about it, but definitely mad about, like, hey, you're taking an A, you're taking something, but not, you know, not necessarily that you have to earn A or C, but you do. It's like you have to earn their respect. It's so when you're wearing something like this, you've been stamped as a leader. Whatever you do, you're a leader. So when somebody else comes in and takes it away, and gives it to somebody else without even giving me a chance to prove myself to you, to the new coach, is a definitely a few kind of a thing. You know, it's like, hey, listen, I come in, I'm the new sheriff, and I'm going to do whatever you want. And, you know, there's a lot of other, there's a lot of staff changes have been from general manager to coaches. So the new sheriffs were in town and they basically said, we're going to run it how we wanted it. So forget about what it was 2 or 3 years ago prior to that. It's a new thing. And yeah, I did not get along very well with the management team for that reason. Like I said, hey, give me a chance to earn your respect if so, but don't take my respect out. You know,
right.
So that was definitely disappointed. And, you know, even during that year, you know, all of a sudden, you know, when I played 1 minute 45 on a power play, you go into maybe a second unit for 45 seconds, or, you know, key situation used to go to my stick and all of a sudden it goes to somebody else's stick, which is fine again, but you took it away because of it and not because I did not earn my spot. Right. So of course, as a player, as a, you know, anybody with that kind of a responsibility, when you take it away, you get upset. And, but again, I'm not the one that's going to say, "Hey, I deserve it. Let me earn it."
Right. Yeah. I mean, and there's a difference between being mad about it and also pouting about it. And that's one of the things I talk to players about, right? Like it can be a poor me, or it can be, well, no, I mean, I'm going to use this, right, to either prove you wrong or to still be professional about it. But yeah, that's a tough one. I mean, that's definitely a tough one, because I could see how the ego could get involved in that. You mean quite naturally, because you didn't do anything not to, you know, that would have determined or deterred you from losing it, right? It was just start of a new regime and then they take it away. So that'd have been a tough pill to swallow, especially after, you know, which was your best NHL career, almost a point a game, 35 goals, right? Like, you have a great year. You obviously looks like you grew with that letter, and then all of a sudden someone comes in and takes it away. Yeah, that would have been a tough one.
It's a great adversity, but like I said, you always got to learn and, you know, fight through it. If everything was easy in life, that would be fantastic, but it's not. So how do we deal with that?
Yeah. Maybe we'll end just because you did get a chance. You got traded, or I'm not sure if it was a trade or you signed as a free agent, but you ended up going to Florida and ended up getting to play with your brother. And was that something that was high in the priority list? Like, did you guys want that to happen? Is that something that just worked its way out and you ended up being on the same team, or walk me through that?
Well, you know, I was hoping that it was going to happen at the draft when they draft me, and I would be able to play with my brother. And it's always been a dream. And it's not only to play with my brother, but, you know, just to be with him. You know, even growing up, we didn't spend much time together because he's 3 years older. So he's in one team, I'm in one country, I'm completely different. So to be able to be now an adult and spend the time together, and the best part was, as a matter of fact, not only to play with my brother, but to be with him in the dressing room, to talk to him, go for dinners together. That was the biggest part, because you know what? I train with my brother. I know what he's all about and how he trains and how hard he wants it. Because a lot of people are surprised to see it, because they're like, well, he scores 60 goals. And then they go, but you know what? He never misses during the practice. He never misses. He scores almost 100% of the time that he shoots, just on the warm-up drills. And if there is a rebound, the puck is going to go in the net, and the, you know, the goalies always get pissed off, but he just like, no, I finish everything that I do. And I know that, you know, I grew up with him, obviously. So the way it did happen, I think, you know, after my year in Calgary, you know, obviously I didn't get along with management after that season. So, you know, I never obviously asked for trade again, because I love Calgary. I, you know, the fans, the city, the everything is about it. It's just, I love that. At the time, my brother was very close to the team owner and a president in Florida Panthers. So he went up to them and said, hey, you know, how can we get my brother to play with me? So a lot of that move has to go with my brother and Mr. Torrey at the time. So they kind of made it happen. And I was surprised. I received a phone call and I couldn't believe it. You got traded. And I'm like, okay, well, I'm kind of sad. And then they go, well, we traded you to Florida Panthers. So that was exciting just for that reason, that I get the chance to spend a time with my brother. And we did. It was a short lived because my brother ended up getting traded. I actually played, I want to say, I don't remember, maybe 7-10 games in the beginning, and my knee gave up right in the beginning of the season, and I ended up having a surgery, and I didn't play for months and months. Came back just in time for Olympic Games, and we played a little bit, and then he got traded. So that was short-lived, but it was one of the best times in my National Hockey League career, and not because of on ice, but off ice to be with my bro.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. Awesome, man. Well, is there anything else, like any other lessons you talked about? Like, maybe that's a good way to leave, because, like I said, with my audience and who's listening, and usually it's young players growing up, it's the adversity that we're trying to avoid. It seems like, especially in the moment, but generally it's the adversity that kind of galvanizes us and creates who we are, you know. And those are the good minds. Well, when you look back on everything that, you know, encompassed your career, what was the thing that you think was your kind of defining moment, as far as the thing that you got through that allowed you to be Val Burray?
It's a good question. I never thought of that question. I just thinking of my career back, and I'm kind of thinking of, you know, Spokane on, because that's when I came here, and could have been different, but I'm like, I would not change one single thing of what happened. You know, what Western Hockey League taught me and Brian Maxwell taught me, try to be a professional, try to work hard. I always have that work ethic, and adversity of, you know, when I scored 68 goals in the Western Hockey League, I had a bad days that I still have to fight and all of go through something. And then there were periods when in the National Hockey League, I believe I have not scored a goal for 30, 40 games. And I go, I did not forget how to score. I just didn't. But they're not going in. I will, you know, hit the post, another post, and the puck comes out. I would score the goal and they disallow it. And I'm going, just stick with it. And those are the things that you realize that, you know, in life, there's always going to be an obstacles, whatever it'll be on the ice and off the ice, but perseverance, you just got to keep on going. And it's easy to give up. It's easy to go say, well, it's just not this and that, but you don't know how close you are to a success. It's very close, but it's that extra final step that you're ready to give up and ready to say no, but push yourself. And that's what Brian Maxwell taught me. That's what, you know, people through my career just continue to teach me. You're very, just push yourself. And when you do, it feels and tastes so good when you arrive there. And once you arrive there, you want to do it again and again. And it's not only, like I said, not only in hockey, but in life in general. So, you know, when you think you reach the limit, there's another step.
Yeah, I love that. That's a great way to end. Because that is where the juice is, right? That's where the pot of gold is at the end of the rainbow. And I think it is the definition of us as people, is like what we're willing to do to get somewhere. And that sometimes is the defining moment, right? It doesn't come easy. It comes after some challenge, it comes after some adversity. And it was awesome that you were able to play the 621 games and the 400 points and all the rest of that. It was fun to watch you do it. So thanks for sharing your story today, Val. I really appreciate it. I know there's a whole family life there that I'm sure you get asked about all the time, with your wife and your kids and what she's up to and the winery. But I thought we'd just stick to some hockey today. I hope you're okay with that.
I love it. I don't get to talk about hockey. That's the first time in years.
Awesome.
That was exciting.
Awesome. All right, man. Well, till next time, I'll hold on here after, but I'll just cut off now. And we'll talk to you soon. Well, thank you so much for sticking around till the end of my discussion with Valeri Burray, an old teammate of mine from the Spokane days, where he was able to shed some light on his, 10-year NHL career, 621 games, 174 goals, 400 points. What a career that was. And I do think it was interesting when I was doing the research there that he, him and Jerome, not only were they roommates, but they actually had the exact same amount of goals over the three seasons that they played together. Jerome McGinley is a household name in the hockey world, and Valeri, maybe not quite so much, but during that point in time when they're only a year apart in age, I believe maybe 2 years apart in age, that they were essentially playing the same type of hockey when it came to the point production. And I can't tell you how professional this guy was in his approach. He was always dialed in. And him telling that story about golfing and, hey, do you want to go golfing? And he said, what do you mean golfing? When are we going to do this golfing? I'm too busy working out. I'm too busy getting myself better. This was his approach. And when he mentioned that it's not going to happen, it's just not going to happen playing in the NHL or making whatever dream you want come true, you need to give yourself the best opportunity for that dream to happen. And that is really what it is at the end of the day that I'm working with hockey players about, is like, how do you give yourself the best chance to do whatever it is you want to do? And if you aren't taking care of your controllables in a way that's professional, in a way that's real and deliberate, then you're just wishful thinking. Because it's super, super hard. And whatever that level is, whether it's you want to become a junior player, whether you want to become a pro player, get played for hockey, whether you want to become an NHL player, there is going to be a level of mental commitment. There's going to be a level of physical commitment. There's going to be a level of emotional commitment that you have control over that will be required for it to happen. And my job is to help you understand these different areas of your development that you can raise your standards in, that you can now have a game plan or a program to make your personal operating manual stronger and better. Now, obviously, you don't have, not everyone's going to be a pro. Not everyone's going to get a D1 scholarship. But we do want to play the best hockey that we can, too. That's like a fun scenario. That makes the game more enjoyable when we feel in control and we are getting what we want from the game. So this applies whether you want to be a professional or whether you just want to be a good hockey player and enjoy your time. So remember that there's more buckets than just the physical buckets of a hockey player. There is the mental game around being a hockey player. There is the training of being a hockey player when you're not on the ice. There's also the emotional component of being a hockey player. That is all very, very relevant on your journey. And I think that Valeri was one of those guys coming over from Russia and with the father that was the Olympic swimmer that understood what it took to be at the pinnacle of his sport, an older brother that was dialed in from an early age to be better than his peers. Wanted to be better himself, that there was a biological piece to Valeri, and also a piece that he just embraced and absorbed, and a standard that he created for himself that was very, very palatable for me. Like that I could see, that I could see his example, I could see how he went about his business, that definitely had an impact on me. Which I think is another great lesson from Valeri, is that at whatever point you're at, whatever team you're on right now, you have the ability to impact others, either positively or negatively. And Valeri definitely left his imprint on me in a positive way. And without having conversations with me, without going, taking me for lunch or anything else, it was just me watching him go about his business that was very, very impactful. And it's one of the things that I work on with players who want to be leaders. Leadership is about that. It's about your example and how you do you. That's much more important than any speech you're going to say in the locker room, but how do you? And Valeri was very committed to who Valeri was, and that was something that I'll always remember from Valeri. So lots of good stuff from this conversation. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did, and until next time, play hard and keep your head up.